Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This podcast is for people on the open mic comedy circuit. Whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, anybody who has any involvement in this crazy industry, even comedy fans who really do enjoy spending their time in pub basements watching the possible stars of the future. If you think I could do that, then this podcast will give you the inside track on what to expect if you enter this circuit. Today's guest, today's guest is someone who's new to me, someone who's moved over to the UK from Europe and has begun his comedy journey. So let's learn all about him together. So please welcome to the stage, it's Steer. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's okay. So yeah, as I mentioned, you're kind of new to me. I haven't seen you around or anything on the actual circuit itself. So give us a little bit of information on your background then. How have you got here and stuff like that?
So my background story is more of when I came to the UK, it's been around 6 years ago. Yeah. So I traveled to study, and then the way that I enter into stand-up is I always felt in love with stand-up, even if in Portugal is still a new ground. But like yeah. from what I knew from my earliest teenager times, I always enjoy that and being close to see them shows live that and friends is trying to motivate me to do it. That's when I start trying to do stand-up.
So did you just think, what was your first ever gig then?
Was in Portsmouth, the place that I'm living right now at the moment. I've been living for around 5 years around here. And I was just here studying. And back then, it starts the pandemic. So even when I tried to start for the first time, I couldn't because everything closed down.
Yeah.
So my first time, in an ironic way, I was to start in Portuguese, doing stand-up in Portuguese in Portugal. But because everything got canceled, I just was able to do it in English later on. And probably if I did the Portuguese as a starter, probably I would ever even try English. So it's a funny way of like, oh, okay, I got into English, then I fell in love, and now I've been doing for a while.
So you didn't actually do any kind of course or anything. You just went straight in and did an open mic. So I think you must be one of the first people who kind of just went, I'm just going to do this then, that I've interviewed so far. So how did you, what interests me is, did you actually have a set created or something, or is it just I'm going to go on and make it up as I go along?
I had a bunch of sets, but the one that I decided to go in my first time, in my 5 minutes first time, was a set that was supposed to be a comedy sketch that I was trying to make in a comedy sketch. And I was trying to get people to a couple of comedians in Portugal and a couple of people that I start to make contacts in the industry, trying to make like their parts on the sketch. But as most people were busy back then, I then was like, this is so good to just throw away. So I just tried to transcript it to stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And funny enough, that's one of the jokes that people still request every now and then, which I hate because it's been a long time and I'm like, I already hate that joke. But people love it, so sometimes I bring it to stage.
Yeah. So that's quite an interesting thing with regards to... So your first gig wasn't in your own language as such?
Yeah.
So how I guess from somebody that only speaks one language, I can't work out how you do that. And the understanding the bits that are funny in Portuguese, do they translate well to being funny in English?
No, because I try in my last shows in Portugal and it doesn't work the same, even the translation from English to Portuguese. So I just got used to when I start doing stand-up, I just got used to thinking English. So that's when I start writing in English the jokes, trying to make sense. And my jokes are a little bit of word playing. It's easy. Yeah. It's easy for me to play around the words, because in English, you guys have so much words that means the same thing.
Yeah.
While like in Portuguese language, one word is just one word. So it's easy for me to like, oh, okay, I'm going to play around the words because I can create this.
Okay. So I guess it's going about thinking in a language rather than translating a language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's something I've never actually been able to try. I mean, I can speak a bit of French, but it's like your school text French. It's like, oh yeah, so the car is that word, green is that word, and then you try to put it together, and I guess you're never quite sure if it's going to work and if it's going to flow. But
Trying. You mentioned that, and this is like I'm also trying. It's one of the things that impress most people as well. Is I know I start doing a bit on Portuguese, like, and I also want to do it in Spanish. So that's like my goal, to like try to do in three languages, like English, Spanish, and Portuguese. So I'm quite ambitious in those terms of like, I don't want just to be known in the English circuit. I want to be known in the Spanish and the Portuguese one. So I'm trying to.
So how many gigs have you done then?
So far, around almost 100.
Yeah. And most of them have all been pretty much all in English. Other than, we're going to get to it later. You did a tour, didn't you, in Portugal?
Yes. Yes.
So I guess how did that come about? How did you, I guess that's all self-organized and stuff like that.
Yeah. Everything that I do is just self-organized. So I just, I have a comedian friend over there that I've been a fan for a long time, and the connection started for me being a fan of the person. Mm-hmm. So then the friendship started. We did a couple of projects, and when I tried to do in Portuguese and tried to even do some spots in English, but in Portugal, I just reached to that person. Is like, who are the promoters that you recommend me to approach to try to book the gigs? How can I contact them? So that's how everything started.
So how many gigs did you do in Portugal?
I did around 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Around those.
Okay. So that's a nice little tour around and just seeing different places. Yeah. And I guess a lot of people, if they gig like in London, you'll be gigging in front of a lot of the same people a lot of the time. But in a place like that, you're probably seeing very different audiences from one gig to another.
And also you need to adapt. That's the thing that I love, is you need to adapt, because the jokes that you might translate, for example, in Portsmouth, that's where I live, it will not translate to Portugal or somewhere. Yeah. So you need to make it universal. The language for everyone to understand.
Talking about rain a lot in the UK works. I guess talking about rain a lot in Portugal may not work so much.
Funny enough, I tried to talk about raining in my set in Portuguese, but it was just like, we don't have any context of England, so we barely speak English, most of them. So it's like, that's fun.
How do you find those when you get those moments on stage where things don't quite go so well?
I think because I started and I still perform a lot around the south of UK, I found it normal, because that's 100% or most of the gigs that I perform. So it's just like everything doesn't go accordingly. So I'm like, another day.
I guess at this level, it's kind of hard to get every gig to be perfect. But I think somebody once said to me that out of every 10 gigs you do, you'll get one that goes amazingly well. You'll probably get 4 that go relatively well. And then you'll get 5 that just go, not very well at all. And try and learn from those 5 to make your next set better.
Yeah. And I always have... People say every time that they come to Portsmouth to perform, that is like, it's the toughest crowd to be around because it's a lot of social workers. Like it's not very cultured in terms of stand-up. So special for me that I'm doing a different type of stand-up, people just look at me. It's like, what is this? Who is this guy? What is he doing on stage? So it's a bit always weird to try to make sense of what I'm doing. So whenever I go somewhere else, and if I know that the joke landed well in Portsmouth, for example, I know that it's going to work well everywhere. It's like that common ground that is like, okay, it worked here, so everyone will enjoy this. This is relatable.
Because you've also got a YouTube channel, haven't you?
Yes.
Where you can kind of see a lot of your adventures and stuff like that. I've had a quick look over the last couple of weeks at a couple of videos and stuff, and I think it was the summary one from zero to success. I kind of found the last clip of that quite funny, where things didn't go quite as well as they could do in the gig. And I always have this, I think they're always some of the most entertaining parts when it doesn't quite go right. If you've forgotten what you're doing or you've mixed something up and something's not going to make sense, it's how you then get out of it there and then in front of an audience who are, they want to be entertained. But I don't know if it's a British thing or not, but the Brits, like, we call it the underdog. They like the person that's not number one. They want to see the person that's number two to succeed. And they just want to be entertained. And when they see something go wrong, they almost find that funnier than when everything goes perfectly right.
They know it's
genuine.
Yeah. The funny thing about that whole performance that day was that's the only thing that went well on my set, that improvising part. Because the rest, I just bumped through the whole set. Because my humor just didn't relate, was too morbid. And people just like, oh, okay, that's too dark. So when I went, and that was like the suicide joke that I have on my special. When I went to that, someone started laughing too much in the background. And I lost, instead of being that laugh that is like everyone is laughing. No, it's just one person laughing in the back of the room too much. Yeah. And I lost track of the joke, of how to say the joke. So I fucked up a little bit the joke. So it was like, then I was like, okay, there is no point of continue this because I already messed up. So let's try improvising. And that's when it came about, that clip.
Yeah, I've had a couple of instances where I've forgotten my set on stage and stuff like that. And you kind of just go, let's see. And I'd just be like open and honest and go, yeah, I've forgotten this bit. I've just standing there on stage. I've just forgotten. I've forgotten where I am. And then you get an audience member starts, they'll chuck a line out at you that you said before, trying to be helpful, but they've said the wrong line. And then you correct them on the wrong line. And then you end up with this paradox of nobody knows what's going on, but everybody's kind of finding it funny. And it's I would love to be able to do more improvised stuff on stage, but it's hard.
I think that depends on the type of comedy that you do and the training, like going with the time, because I start to enjoy more now, but I never enjoy when I had to improvise. Because I felt I was like, oh, I've wrote so much and I need to improvise to save the day. But then I had a comedian friend of mine that said, that's the best part of you is when you improvise. So try to make that a part of a set. So I start trying to incorporate in a certain way.
Yeah.
And trying to feel free to do that. And at the moment is one of the things that I enjoy the most is when I can have those moments of like, oh, I'm just going to rant about something that I can have the free to do this, be weird.
Yeah.
I think it just goes with the stage time, like being comfortable on stage and being comfortable with whatever you're trying to pass as a character or the message.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's one of those things where I think a lot of comedians can also benefit from having plans in their set. So I don't know if you've ever done this before, where you've got, you'll ask the audience a question, and, you know, give me a shout if this has ever happened. But have a response for if you get a cheer and if you don't get a cheer. Because if you always expect a cheer and you don't get one, especially if you're new, it can really throw you off. And then you feel like you're now talking about a subject that nobody has ever had. Hmm. But they probably have, but they've not expressed it. So you feel like you're the only person in this room now that knows about this topic. Whereas if you can have a bit where you then go off on one tangent or off on another, depending on their answer, you can then bring people back into the main kind of story.
I never try that approach to comedy. I just don't enjoy interaction, so I don't try to emancipate interaction with the crowd. And also I feel that the vibe that I portray on stage is nothing that people is like, oh, this guy is nice, I'm going to try to participate with him. So I like that. I like just being there and this, like, people's like, oh, this is too weird, I'm not even trying to communicate with him.
Yeah.
And I just can be whatever and no interruption. It's rare that I have interruptions when I do comedy. It happened a few times, but not very often, I would say.
Yeah, I wonder if sometimes that happens because of the language. Because obviously with English not being the first language, you've got people who are concentrating more trying to work out every word you're trying to say.
Maybe. That could be, yeah.
But I do like the persona on stage. You see it where you just kind of just... It sounds really odd until you've seen one of the videos where you just stand there, very little movement, just leaning against the microphone stand and kind of go, yeah, this is me. Deal with it.
Yeah.
You're trapped in this room for the next 5-10 minutes, so just come along for the ride.
Yeah, it's yeah, that's if you're listening and you're hearing about me the first time, that's exactly the best way to describe it. Just someone that doesn't give a crap about this, like, yep, you're gonna have to be here for the next 10 minutes, 15, 20, whatever, and I'm gonna be me, I'm not gonna try to be someone else. So deal with that. Yeah, that's, yeah.
So you never say, and I don't do my research.
And most comedians, that's the way that they define me as well, is someone that goes on stage and doesn't give a crap about the rest. It's just like, yep, I'm this, I don't care about you guys, I'm just gonna tell you about whatever I find funny or random. And that's about it. Yeah.
So you mentioned here that, like, doing 10-15 minute slots, so is that a... Because a lot of the people that are involved in comedy, especially in the southeast of England, are mainly London-centric. So people generally don't get more than 5 or 7 minute spots because there's so much going on. But I guess in places like Portsmouth and stuff like that, there's a lot less comedians and a lot less comedy nights. So I guess you guys get afforded the more time on stage. Is that right?
Yeah. Like, I can give an example that, like, my second time, I think second or third time, I was already doing 10 minutes,
okay,
a 10-minute spot. Because, as you said, there is not much comedians going around. There is also not a lot of spots to do, so they allow you the opportunity to, like, oh, you want to test? Just go for it if you can, right? 10 minutes. So they give you that chance of performing more than five, and it's really helpful.
Yeah. So have you actually ventured into London to do gigs around London and stuff like that? Or have you mainly stuck around Portsmouth?
I've been doing comedy, as I said to you, off podcasts around the UK a little bit. And I'm starting to try to get into London, trying to do London. Because maybe when this podcast comes out, I'm already in London, living in London. So I'm trying to venture myself into performing in London, but I don't know if it's just me because I'm used to do the 10-minute spots. I don't find challenging, like, the bringer spots. I just find a bit weird. So everything that I'm trying to do is like, okay, I can do a 10-minute spot or more. That's what I normally go for.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Yeah, because The advantage of London, I guess, would be that there is so much going on, so you can find a gig to do almost every night. But it would probably be a 5 or 7 minute to start with. There are certain nights that we'll be giving out headline spots to for tens and stuff like that, but you'll probably end up starting with, they'll want to see you do a 5 first, nail the 5, and then kind of, they then go, okay, then we'll progress them to the 7 and then the 10 kind of thing. But you, I guess you would find that you could, if you were living in London, you could be gigging every single night. Some nights you could even fit in 2 gigs a night.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But yeah, you do end up with the whole bringer scenario. And that becomes another big discussion in itself, whether that's the right way to do things or not. But I think it's outside of London, because there's an appetite for comedy, but there's not much comedy nights on, you get the crowds coming in. So like I live outside of London, for example, and there's a night that's about 5 miles away from me. The guy sells out a week or so after putting the tickets available, which is a month before the gig, and doesn't announce who's on it. And it still sells out every time because it happens once a month. Whereas if you've got something that happens every single night, people then have to make the decision, oh, am I going to go out Tuesday or Wednesday? So you don't get the full crowds, but you do get stage time. So it's a fine balancing act at times, I think.
Yeah, I always just find that, like, I found, like, people that are interested in my service all around the UK and abroad. So it's, like, doing those, especially for me, like, I just feel like, okay, it's not useful when I have offers, for example, to go to Spain or whatever. So it's, like, I always have... And that's one of the reasons as well as I want to move to London, because I'm near to the airport and also I can maybe perform almost every day within a certain place without having to travel a lot. That's my main goal.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll get there. It will take a little bit of time at the start, and it's having the realistic expectations of what promoters are going to do, because you'll be on the bill with lots of... I'm assuming at the moment, if you're on a bill in Portsmouth, you're probably with 6 or 7 other people, relatively low numbers. But you go to London and some of the nights you can be on the bill with 15, 16
Jesus,
people.
That's too much. That's too much.
It's a lot of people. But it's 15 or 16 people doing their 5 minutes or so. So people rattle through, but I guess you get the opportunity to learn to refine small sections of the routine rather than the whole routine.
Yeah. Also, it's like, if I'm living nearby, I think that's acceptable, but the thing that I never try to do living in Portsmouth is just going to London for a 5 minute spot. It's just like, it's too much of a travel to just like do 5 minutes, so... Yeah. Every gig that I do is just like, it needs to be in consideration that is like, oh, the amount of travel that you're going to have, the expenses, and if it's really worth it to go all the way someplace to just...
Yeah, I completely understand. Completely get it. I have to pay... for me to go into London is 20 to 30 pounds every time. And it, you know, sometimes you're just doing the 5 minutes... Depending on what level you are and how you want to progress, if you can get, I dare say, if there were more gigs outside of London that I could be doing 5, 7, 10s, I'd favour them over the going travelling in and out of London.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it's kind of the only thing that I've got. If I wanted to gig once every 2 months, it's like, okay, yeah, that's fine, but it's not going to get me very far. I'm never going to find out if this material is actually any good or not.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. So, do you have any highlight moments at all, like the worst moment you've been on stage, where you've just thought, "No, please get me off." I've had them.
As a comedian, you already have, like, you always have a lot of those. I always enjoy to put those in two categories. That is like the worst moments, in my perspective. Sometimes it's not that bad as I thought, but it could be better, because you always have, like, especially me, I always have the perspective that I could do better in some instance or some joke, saying something there. So in that regards, For example, when I did Portugal, I opened for one of the biggest stars in Portugal at the moment, me and four other comedians, and we performed for 300 people. That's like a huge achievement for most of the comedians.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I felt because I was doing a five-minute spot and I was doing in Portuguese, was my first time in Portuguese, I kind of felt that it could be more than what it got. It got some laughs, but the material in Portuguese was not very crafty, was not as well as I know I could do in English, for example. So,
yeah.
In regards to the English, like a bad set, I would say, and this is among all the horrible sets, I think this is a funny story, trying to bring a little bit of comedy to this. Yeah. I had one set that I performed in Portsmouth. I was testing material before recording my short special that, in case you guys want to see, is in my YouTube. It's called Morbid Thoughts. It's an 8-minute special.
Yeah.
And I was testing the material, trying to make sure everything that then would be recorded would be fine. And I'm almost getting into my material about suicide. And there is this drunk guy that kept heckling me on it was really drunk, this old guy. So he kept heckling me. He starts saying a lot of jokes about suicide, murders, whatever. And he start trying to stand up, trying to go away. But it's just the way that when he goes to the door to get out, he just slams into a table. So I'm like, how am I supposed to follow my rest of my set that is like 6 minutes left? Compared to this, I don't have any jokes compared to this. This is more funny than my actual material. So how am I supposed to follow this? So that's like the sort of stuff that sometimes happens to me that is like, why this happens to me? And from that, back then, I was working on a customer service job. And most people from my job start knowing that I did stand-up because of that clip that went kind of viral. Not viral, but it got a couple of good numbers.
Yeah.
So people start to know, oh, you do stand-up. I was like, yeah, I've been doing stand-up for almost a year and a half or something like that. And you notice me because some guy slammed into a table. That's quite nice. Thank you very much for the compliment. Not for my material, for the guy slamming into a table. Yes. So, yeah, that's always perfect.
Yeah. So how... What about the other side, the best moments on stage where you've just kind of walked off and gone, that was just amazing?
I think my best moment so far has been when I recorded the special. It truly was an amazing event because I went all the way to Cambridge to record the special.
Yeah.
I love Cambridge crowds. So far it's been my best crowds. People really love what I do, the abstract comedy, everything. So we got the 50 sold out venue.
Yep.
And as soon as my first joke landed, like the laugh, the loudness of the laugh was just, you couldn't get through to get another joke before they stopped laughing. So that's what you want when you're performing. It's just like a laugh that doesn't allow it to, like, oh, I'm going to continue this. No, you can't. They will not hear you. The laugh is louder than the sound from the stereo. So that's for me, it's been one of the best moments so far in my career.
Excellent. So is there future plans then to do more of that, I guess?
What, the short specials or specials? Yeah. Yeah, I have. The thing is, I try to record one, a long one, this year. I booked the venue, I dealt with everything, but ended up not going as well as I planned.
Yeah.
So I couldn't put that outside.
Okay.
So yeah, I've been planning on trying to do, but the material that I've been doing so far is, I don't think is solid enough. The new material is not solid enough still to put outside.
Mm-hmm.
Because of, as I said off camera, by the time we are talking, and maybe when it gets out, I already finished, but I'm finished my last year of university. So this year, I've not focused a lot of writing on testing new material. There's not a lot going on around here. So there is not a lot to test. So I stop a bit of writing and I just try to focus on doing professional nights.
Yeah.
Which I get the material from my special and others to like perform those professional nights. So I kind of stop the testing.
So have you thought about going towards like the fringes, so the Brighton Fringe and the Edinburgh Fringe?
I don't. This is going to sound controversial, and I know that because a lot of people say that to me, but I don't feel that useful. I don't agree with the whole methodology of doing a fringe.
Yeah.
I feel it is more useful, especially for when you're beginning and you don't have an agent, if you want an agent, or you're just doing all on your own, to just travel and going abroad. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, like, there is places in the UK that, as there is not a lot of comedy, people recognize everyone that goes there and is like, oh, we appreciate your effort.
Yeah.
While if you're going to a crowd place that is getting comedy like hour by hour every day, I don't think they will appreciate what you're doing. It's just another one instead of one.
I see what you mean. No, I think that's, that makes sense. It does. It is controversial for what other people will do. But yeah, I understand what you mean in that you want people to be there to kind of see you rather than just, we'll just pick another show to go and see. We've got an hour spare. Let's go there.
Yeah. Because that was my thought when I did the shows in Portugal. First of all, was being close to my family that I came here alone to the UK. So it was like, was a nice way to go there for a few months and stay with family.
Yeah.
It's been a while, that amount of time just being around. But also I felt it was like, because I've been doing in English for so long, also going there, the appreciation from Portuguese crowds would be different, and was, because it was like, we have the opportunity to see someone that might be the next star, or just someone that has been doing on a different circuit, in a different level, with higher demand. So it was more, people respected more and appreciated more than if it was in here, for example.
Yeah, I was about to actually ask what do you see the differences in, we've kind of spoken about the difference between gigging in the UK and kind of Portugal. What's the difference in the crowd itself?
In terms of English crowds, I think is most of the comedy that is worth playing, they will not get it because the English is most of the times is very basic. So they can understand you, but if you're playing around words, it might be confusing for them because they just know one meaning for certain words.
Yeah.
Which can make difficult to the joke work. So it also makes you approach, if you're like a one-liner, like I always did, always makes you approach the storytelling because that's like more familiar style to them and more easy to get a laugh.
Yeah.
So it's always trying a different one, trying to make sense of certain things that happen and try to be relatable. One of the materials that I did, for example, to give an example on what I did in Portugal, I try to talk about my experience as a foreigner in the UK because people can relate with the struggles of going to another country or even being in Portugal. It's like, oh, I traveled to Spain and I didn't know how to speak Spanish. So that kind of mentality is to relate than just a word-playing joke.
Yeah, I guess if you try to compare what would be normal in Portugal to what happens in the UK, the UK crowds probably find that quite funny.
Yeah,
in that it's taking taking the Mickey out of ourselves. In that it's, you know, I don't know why we have 400 different colored bins and stuff like that, whereas in other countries they just chuck everything in together. And you talk about. It's a silly example, but you know what I mean, where some of the stuff that happens in the UK just doesn't make sense. And especially when you get somebody whose first language isn't English and they try to say a particular county's name or a place in the UK. You see an American try and say Leicestershire and it just becomes funny. And it's just like, why did we come up with a name like that? You know, but with regards to the crowds themselves, is it a case of that the UK crowd is how do I put it? They like to interact sometimes. And I'd imagine this is the case, but please tell me if I'm completely wrong, but like a crowd in mainland Europe are a lot more calmer and they listen a lot more.
Yeah, I would say so, because first of all, like, you're speaking as well when you're doing like gigs around Europe or whatever around the world in English. English is their second language as well, so they are more keen to listen because they're like, oh, I'm also learning English at the same time. So it's kind of that experience of like, oh, I learned a new word and also I laughed. It's that experience, while in English is like, oh yeah, I know the language, so I can. Yeah. I think it goes around those terms a bit.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because I work with in my job, I work with people that live in Germany, Holland, Belgium. And I've got one friend of mine in Germany who is German. He's born and bred German. And he'll occasionally send me a message and say, how do I say this? What does this word mean? And he'll say, my wife learned all her English from Beatles songs and things like that. And she doesn't understand why this word doesn't work. And I try to explain that. I'll end up saying, well, this word has two or three different meanings. Yeah. So it depends how you want it to sound. But again, I guess to us, it's just that is the language and that's what we deal with. And we don't see the struggles from trying to get to our language from a different one.
And also, like you mentioned, the meanings and being different words for one thing. I had family members that, like, when I post on Facebook, like a joke or whatever, and I put the description, they translate from Facebook. And they say, this doesn't make sense in Portuguese. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not trying to write in Portuguese in English. I'm just writing in English. And there is certain words that the Google Translator or Facebook Translator just doesn't make sense. So I started to have a filter when I post the stuff, because it's like, oh, I can't say this word because the translation of this is not going to make sense.
Yeah.
It's a little bit weird, like, having to think about all of these circumstances instead of just sometimes just, oh, I'm just going to post this because this means this and people will get it.
Yeah. Okay. So here's an interesting one then. Your favorite joke or your best joke? It doesn't, either one, they can be different. How that joke came about and has it changed over time, or have you stuck with the first draft?
One of my favorite jokes is a joke that doesn't work a lot. It just needs to have a specific crowd. But it's a joke that I wordplay with why English people, why people that speak English say the words many thanks.
Yeah.
Why do we need to quantify thanks? If thanks is not enough, you need to add something. So sometimes I feel that people don't just think on that, and it's difficult to relate with certain crowds. So I don't do that joke very often. But when I know that I can do, it always gives me pleasure to just go forward and
explore that.
And that came from like just normal interaction, just people talking normally on the streets or whatever. I listened. I was like, oh, this doesn't make sense in my point of view. Like, as a foreigner, like putting something to quantify something that is already enough doesn't make sense.
I guess you could use goodbye and bye and bye-bye.
Yeah.
As another kind of example.
Yeah, but like my point on that joke was like, you don't say less thanks. So why do you say many thanks? What's the correlation between the two? Because if you say one, you should be able to say the other one without, oh, this is weird, and the other isn't. That's like always how I try to break a joke, is like trying to go for the different perspectives of both sides.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. It's quite clever. It comes back to taking the piss or taking a mickey out of the English people and English language. Why do you do this? It makes no sense.
Yeah.
There's no logic to what you're trying to say. It's the same as just saying that one word. Why make it two?
Yeah. I never thought about that word, but I thought about like other stuff that I don't understand, but I feel that it just doesn't translate. People don't think about it. And there was one joke that I tried to make it work that I just never could so far. And I can tell here on a brief of it that was like, why people still on regards to thanking someone is like, why people thank someone for everything? It's like, yeah. Oh, congratulations for this. Congratulations for that. It's like, why? Why congratulations for everything? You are diminishing the congratulations word. Like, oh, you have your baby. Congratulations for having lack of sleep for a couple of months. Nice. And it's like, I just don't understand why you need to congratulate everything that you do. It's just like this.
Yeah. This is what I find fascinating is when you speak to a non-English person and they point out the flaws in the language and the stuff that we do and why we do it, and we don't know why we do half the stuff that we do. It's just there, and don't know, I can't explain it.
Now talking about that as well, like I have another example that also I tried to make in a joke. And this is two jokes exclusive for this podcast, which is great. So I don't also understand why English people, when they say a bad word, a swear word, say excuse my French when you're clearly speak English.
Yeah.
It's just, it doesn't make sense in my little brain of like, why you're saying excuse my French. It's like, that's English for sure. I'm pretty sure that's English.
There probably is something in the background that's to do with the French and English rivalry, and you see the other language as something that's bad, and it's that,
yeah, maybe
it's that thing. But I understand exactly what you're saying. It's one of those jokes that probably was quite relevant 40 or 50 years ago, but then when you come to the modern day, It's a little bit less relevant, especially how multicultural the UK is. But it's one of those phrases. There's always particular phrases in the language that I can't think of any, but they're there and they just don't make sense, but they're said a lot.
Yeah.
That must be a real challenge.
Like, yeah. The thing is, every one of us, even if I make fun of it, because society demands that you use those words, we use it in a daily to day basis.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, that's the way to show appreciation or whatever. But as a part of comedian, I always try to challenge that point of view, even if I am the cause as well of contributing to continue to say those. But it's like, yeah. I'm just trying to challenge you to think differently. This is not going to change anyone's perspectives. I'm not trying to change anyone's mind. I'm just trying to make you laugh with how absurd all this.
Yeah. No, that's, yeah. I like it a lot.
Because
go on.
Yeah, because one of my favorite, and for British people, I think it's a common taste, but there is still a lot of people that don't enjoy Monty Python. For me, it's a huge inspiration, like for what they do, like that absurd comedy that even today's day is just can be relatable so much in so many things. And it's just like, they make fun of like basic stuff. It's not like, oh, let's talk about something in the news.
Yes.
No, it's just like, let's make...
Yeah, I think Monty Python's more is more of an inspiration outside of the UK than it is within the UK. I think that's on a comedy scene anyway. It's very much an old school type comedian in the UK that would do those type of pun jokes and that kind of material. And the play on words is rather than like as you say the storytelling and stuff like that, it's very much an older comics type of vibe, I think.
Oh really? I didn't talk about it. That's interesting.
So when I see certain people on the circuit in London, if you look at like the age demographics, you'll see that the older guy is the one that's going to be doing the puns, the one-liners and everything like that. And then it's usually going to be the younger guy that's going to be doing the storytelling and all of that. Oh, and then you've got the ones that fit in between that try to bring in a story but using one-liners and stuff like that. And it's interesting how you see so many different diverse things. I don't know if you get odd things or anything else like that that happens on in Portugal and stuff, but I've seen comics that pretend to be snakes and slugs on stage.
Yeah, I saw some comedians that is like, okay, this is too bizarre to work outside the UK. this just doesn't translate. I've seen a couple of them. That is just too weird to work outside, because it's just, yeah, okay, in the UK this works. Yeah. I don't think if you're going to try to bring this material to anywhere abroad, that's going to translate. People just don't make sense of it.
Yeah.
But I think, like, as you said, Monty Python, people abroad also appreciate, probably. Mm. I don't know if it's as much as the UK or as the same, but people appreciate like that abstract humor. Eddie Izzard is the example of that. It's like, is a mix of those styles.
Yeah. So who are the UK stars as such that people in Portugal would continually watch?
I would say like Eddie Izzard is one of those. Is like some people know about his comedy. Yeah. Especially because he also tried to go to America and there's like, he's known in America. So it's James A. Custer.
Okay.
It's someone that is like, because he's been on America. I think it's like most people that try to go to America and are known in America, like Portuguese people can recognize them.
Okay,
I don't think like British humor, most people don't know about it unless they've been here and watch. It's just like, I think it lacks promotion and publicity. While the Americans already figured out how to share their stories, their jokes, British is still like, oh, okay, I will do, but I will keep to myself. Everyone in here knows who I am, but outside, they have no clue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I think that there is, go on. I was going to say, I think there's something in, as I've noticed when I've been abroad and stuff, there's TV channels in, especially in mainland Europe, that I've seen. This might be a complete blanket statement, but they love a chat show. Every channel when I was in the Netherlands, you're flicking through it, it's like, it's another chat show, it's another chat show, it's another chat show.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of that, but you don't see, they're happening at sort of like early evening in Holland. But in the UK, the chat shows that focus on like comedy and life and stuff generally happen late at night, so less people watch them.
Oh yeah, no, the chat shows, for example, in Portugal, since you mentioned that, is like early afternoons. Is like that's, and normally it's not comedy. Normally, is especially in Portugal. I don't know what their obsession is, but it's everyone that had a sad story. It's like, oh, this person, his friend died in a car accident. Let's bring to the chat and let's milk the cow of this person that is sad to make views to the old people that is watching at home. That's the main television in Portugal. So,
and then they bring out the car that their friend died in, watch him cry live on stage.
That would be fantastic. That I would watch. But normally it's just someone crying too much and the other person is like, yeah, I understand. And they probably close camera and is like, yeah, that's enough for me today. I'm gonna... it's just a lot of like hypocrisy there in those regards.
Yeah.
And they start to putting like stand-up in the late nights.
Yeah.
Culture of stand-up starts to be something, but it's still like ground zero. It's still very earliest days.
Okay, so this is probably going to be quite a strange question to ask yourself because of how you got into it, but do you have any tips for people that have just started into comedy? What would you say the one thing that they should start concentrating on? Or
write as much as you can. That's my first one. no matter if it's shit or not, just try to write. One of the things that I do normally is trying to write as much as I can during a month.
Yeah.
I leave on rest, and then I watch it after not knowing what I wrote. And then you can filter as like, oh, this is shit. This is shit. This is will never work. I don't know what I thought why this was funny. Still, not sure why I thought this was funny. Fair enough. I quit off this page. Let's go to another one. So it's a little bit of that procedure of like writing, leave it to rest, because then when you're reading again, you don't remember what you wrote.
Yeah.
So you can have a fresh pair of eyes to like, oh, okay, I wrote this. Jesus Christ, this is awful. This will never make anyone laugh. This will just make people cringe. So I work that way. I work on writing. Then I print them off, which most people don't need to do. It just works for me to print them off. I enjoy reading them on paper. And then I do that selection. And then from that selection, normally I take to the stage, which that also gives you another selection. So it's double off the selection that you probably just take if you just write and take to the stage.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. It's a you allow a joke to breathe and try and work out why you did it at a later date. Get down as much information as you can.
Also, a good friend of mine in drawing, she's an artist drawing stuff, animating stuff. She said one thing that I truly agree, that is, don't attach yourself to your creation, because that is difficult to, like, if the joke sucks, to just, okay, this doesn't work, let's just throw it out, or just leave it in a notebook and then try months after trying to work again. But just don't focus too much of your energy on something that is not working, because it might be just some words that you need to twitch around. But if you're just focused on that and not coming from it, you're just wasting your time during that period of time that you could be dedicating to the ones that work and perfect those ones. Yeah, the second tip I would say that is, don't be afraid of reaching to anyone, asking for help, or asking for advice. Because the first ever advice that I got from someone that, so far I think the person has a lot of Netflix specials, but I just messaged out of nowhere. I'm just like, I saw this special, I really enjoy, let's message, I don't know how to start.
Yeah.
And the person was really nice and gave me advice of like, oh, try to seek where is the open mics. The open mics is this. Try to have a look where you can do that sort of stuff. And from then, I just researched what I could do.
Yeah.
And most people, even if you think they're like, oh, they are super famous, if they have the time to reply and help, they probably will do.
Yeah.
Just to like, oh, okay, you need this. Just try to do this. Just try to... They probably even will coach you, like, oh, this is the way that I did during... So the maximum answer or the worst answer that you can get is a no. So what do you have to lose? Just send the message.
Yeah, that's very true. It's like there's a podcast that was released a little while ago in relation to this one with a promoter who puts on a night called Rise Up Comedy in London. And what they do is they the quality of the headliners they get in is astounding. You know, we're talking like proper TV comics that are going on full UK, Europe-wide tours, and people that are regularly on TV. And you can be in the same room as them watching that. If you can get on the bill for those kind of nights, you're in the same room as them, and you can learn from them, and you can speak to them, and they'll probably just give you honest feedback about stuff if you ask them, because ultimately they're in a place where they're learning their craft as well for an upcoming tour or something. They're honing their craft and working out these particular jokes. So sometimes you're just in a room with a normal person on the same level.
Yeah, and also, like, you need to remember when you're starting that the person that you're reaching that now is successful has been there too. Has been in that spot that you are right now. So they know the struggle that is starting at not knowing. So if they can help you, like, get through some things that no one told them how to do, that makes you an easy path to then just work around what is important instead, like the admin stuff, like all the things that you need outside the creative side. So
yeah, that can always possibly even put you in touch with other people that might be in a better position to help. So like you say, the worst they can say is no or ignore you. I like that. That actually, just go forward and try it. Just see what happens. I mean, ultimately, we all went forward at one point and tried it and got on the stage. So that, what's more nerve-wracking than doing that for the first time?
and like that brings me to a point that a friend of mine in Portugal, like a famous comedian in Portugal right now, said once to me that he was like, if someone gets on a stage, I already admire them because they took the time and the courage to try to do something. So just be patient, just go for it. So you already had the balls to do it. So just do the rest. You can do the rest. Just put your mind into it. And one of the most important parts in this entertainment or this industry, that is the entertainment industry, is having a good social game.
Yeah.
Unless you have someone doing it for you. But that's the biggest part. It's not if you're talented. Talented is good. You need to be talented, but you need to have good social skills to get into the places that you need in the first place. So try to focus on 50 on the talent and work and 50 on the social game.
Yeah.
That can be exhausting for some of us. Because I know people, comedians, that are truly introvert and have difficulty making connections, but try to put yourself out there. You already do the hardest part, that is going on stage and talking and making people laugh. So just, you can do the rest. Just put a little bit of time every day to try to do it, and you will be able to do it.
So the interesting thing I think about the introvert part is that sometimes in London, you'll go into a room and you'll see the comics, and they'll be kind of scattered all over the place. They won't necessarily all be sitting together. So just go up and just, it's not kind of make friends, but make yourself known, because then when you're, those connections with people, not only can they turn into the friendship and even somebody who can advise you and be a mentor, or you could support each other with maybe suggesting other people and suggesting how to make a joke better. You'll also, if you're good and you get on with people, then you can get recommended to go to other places. So you'll widen the ability and number of gigs you can actually do.
Yeah, and also, like you mentioned, the friendship, which I didn't thought when you asked, but I think it's important to phrase. Take most people as someone that you know, not make it a friendship, because most people are not your friends. Most people, if they can, and especially if you're in a more successful way, they will try to just take advantage of you. So be aware of that, that especially in the industry of making people laugh or entertaining, there is a lot of that, of people just taking advantage of others or trying to take advantage of others. So be aware of that, and don't let just the others step on you, and be yourself, make the contacts, but feel that there is a difference between friendship and just people that you know and you work with. It's totally a different game.
Yeah, no, that's just more good advice. So on a slightly funnier topic, if you were to become, trying to get words out, especially when you're trying to do comedy, is hard. If you were to become super famous one day in front of, you've got a gig, your first ever gig in front of 5,000 people, you work out on walking out onto a big arena, and you get told, oh, what walk-on music do you want? What do you pick?
The thing is, what I'm into, I don't think most crowds would appreciate, because I'm very into that metal, trash metal, that sort of stuff. So it would be weird to walk into like a full blast of someone screaming. So, probably like a mix more soft. I have one band that is metal, but also some of the songs are very soft in certain way compared to just screaming. And so I would say like maybe Bad Omens, Just Pretend, because it's a bit soft. Also, the message is a bit about being in the world that you're pretending to be someone, you're just trying to survive. So it's kind of also like what comedians try to do, is like survive, observe, and try to communicate. So I think would translate into then a set.
Yeah. Ah, cool. Fair enough. Everybody has completely different choices. It's quite funny. Some people want the rock. Some people want some kind of silly little pantomime music to come on to. Some want silence. It's quite funny how everybody, I think everybody kind of wants a bit of a reflection in what they are, and it's telling the audience what you can expect to come up.
I just don't see like what I'm really into, like people enjoying. I had once that a promoter said to me, "What song do you want to enter in?" And I said like, "Oh, I can enter with this that metal song." And I thought the guy would say no. The guy said yes. So it's just like when I enter. It could at least have checked the music, which was weird for the crowd.
Yeah.
Because if anyone is interesting, just have a look at Carnifex. And it's just like trash deathcore metal.
Yeah.
Which is just someone screaming in the top of their lungs. So the stereo didn't pick exactly the best song. So it seemed that the stereo was kind of failing.
Yeah.
Was like that, and it was just like, man, it was so fun to enter that way. But I feel that for most promoters, I think they need, if they go with that, they need to choose to see what is the choice before.
Yeah,
because everyone is like, oh, I'm going to the Rocky song. I was like, oh, if I can pick someone, I'm going this way. And and they could at least say no. It's like, that's too aggressive.
Yeah.
But no, they just didn't realize. They just realized in the moment, and that was... Back then, I tried to make a clip of it, and I tried to send to the band, but the band ignored me, which was a bit shame. But I had fun, so...
Yeah. No, I think it's great when you have a little bit of fun with it. It's like, it reminds me of the story of... there's an episode recorded with somebody called Richard Parr, who he does... does a bit of like a wrestling ring announcing as a part-time thing done in the past. And the guy that was running at night said, when you come on, do you want me to pick a song for you? Or do you want to tell me what your favorite song is and I'll play it for when you come on. He's like, I don't think it's going to be really that suitable. Bear in mind, he's in a crowd. This is a wrestling crowd. And he went, oh, I'll just put on Enrique Iglesias' Hero and see what happens. Expecting to come out to boos and everything. He said the whole crowd just sung with him. It had a complete opposite reaction to what he expected. That's hilarious.
I just by this point, I just don't feel that I have like a metalhead crowd. So it just doesn't assimilate easily.
Yeah.
Because every time that I go to see a gig, mostly like every gig concert that I go to see is death metal. That's what I have fun. And most people are just not for it. It's fair. I have a friend that says, like, how can you listen to that? And I was like, I listened to that and I fell asleep with that. It makes me comfortable. People screaming is like just... People are like, oh, I want to listen to white noise. And I'm like, yeah, I'm listening to white noise. He's a white guy screaming. That's white noise as possible. That's fine for me. I can sleep with that.
I guess we're kind of slowly wrapping this up. But so what's all the socials that people can find you on? And I'll put those in the description of the podcast.
The easiest way to find me, I think, is through my YouTube. That's what I normally try to focus my content. Again, this might sound controversial, especially in the area that, part of the world that everyone is focused on creating short content. I always try to make vlogs. I always try to go for the long format. That's what creates me joy. So... if you go to YouTube and you search Steer Productions, you will easily find it. Probably will be in the link too. And through that, even on the description of every video or just the main channel, there is the links to Instagram, Facebook, whatever social medias I'm in. It will be there too. So,
okay, cool. And you can find us on Instagram at Open Mic Comedy Pod. We're on the W's, openmiccomedypod.com. Whichever platform you're listening to this on, please give it a nice little review. And if you know any friends or anyone that you think will be find this kind of content useful, please do share it with them. And if there's any comedians out there that want to come on and tell a story or promote an event or a night, DM me on Instagram and we'll get you on and we'll have a chat. And until next time, thank you very much, Steya.
You're welcome. I really enjoy. It was a nice conversation. And I hope the cool. listeners enjoy too.
I'm sure they have done. Also, until next time, keep being funny on the stage and I'll speak to you all very soon.